Welcome to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm your volunteer reader, Neil Kelly. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines from the Valley and the State and USA Today. Our first article is titled, Safety, Medical Care, Overcrowding, Top Worries at Eloy Detention Center. The sound of running feet jolted Maribel Alarcon Gomez awake before dawn. She and her roommate, housed on the lower level of Charlie 200 inside the Eloy Detention Center, heard chaos echoing through the concrete halls as guards began unlocking cell doors. It was about 4 a.m., May 5th, normally the time women start emerging from their cells for breakfast, but this morning something was wrong. My roommate came down from her bed and told me everyone is leaving, let's go, Alarcon Gomez recalled in an interview with the Arizona Republic. The women exited their cell, confused and suddenly in the middle of a bustling scene. There was a lot of screaming. People were coming and going, Alarcon Gomez, a 32-year-old Mexican citizen, said in Spanish. There were a couple of guards, one with an extinguisher, running, too. But they weren't headed to the area where the incident was happening, where the microwaves were. One of the two microwaves downstairs had an electrical issue, causing an evacuation, Fernando Burgos Ortiz, an Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokesperson, told the Republic. The smell was a horrible rubber smell, Alarcon Gomez recalled in a July phone interview with the Republic. It was unbearable. The guards, instead of taking us out through the emergency exit, took us through where the fire was, she said, referring to the exits in each respective cell pod. They made us inhale the smoke. The place was white. You couldn't see a thing. Asked about fire safety training for both guards and detainees, an ICE spokesperson did not respond. Brian Todd, public affairs manager at Core Civic, the Brentwood, Tennessee-based for-profit prison company, runs the Eloy Detention Center, told the Republic in a written statement that staff there responded at 4:04 a.m. May 5th to a microwave oven fire in a unit. As a precautionary measure, at 4:06 a.m., all individuals in the impacted area were quickly and safely relocated to the outdoor recreation area to mitigate any potential risks, Todd said. Upon confirmation that the issue with the microwave had been abated and there were no additional electrical issues, everyone returned to their living areas. The facility has 9 fire drills per month, and the most recent drill that occurred before the May 5th incident was May 1st. Each cell POD at the Eloy Center has emergency exit doors. Alarcon Gomez said she used her hands to feel her way out of the building before making it out to the yard. Outside, everyone was coughing. Some lay on the ground, trying to fill their lungs with fresh air. Alarcon Gomez described a few women as seeming to be on the verge of unconsciousness, their bodies giving up. We called to the guards for help, but they wouldn't come. They wouldn't even let us help them, Alarcon Gomez said. Center staff became aware of a medical issue during the incident that Todd said was unrelated to the microwave fire, noting that ICE's Health Service Corps is responsible for contracting, staffing, and oversight of any medical and mental health services at the facility, and that further inquiries should be directed to them. Facility staff called a medical emergency and began life-saving measures until ICE's Health Service Corps, IHSC, staff arrived and took over providing medical care, Todd said in Corps Civic's written response. What happened inside the Eloy Detention Center on May 5th is the latest in what immigration advocates, attorneys, and current and former detainees describe as a pattern of mismanagement that endangers the lives of the detainees in their care at the privately run Eloy Detention Center. Operated by Core Civic under a recently extended contract with ICE, Eloy has historically faced scrutiny, with one of the highest numbers of in-custody deaths at a single ICE detention center, 16 since 2005, according to a figure from 2019. Now, with the surge in detentions under President Donald Trump's hardline immigration agenda, and with weakened oversight after cuts to watchdog offices within the Department of Homeland Security, advocates say conditions are growing increasingly dangerous. The situation is renewing concerns over detainee safety, legal access, and the federal government's expanding reliance on an already strained immigration detention system. As of July 17th, ICE was detaining just shy of 57,000 people nationwide, according to agency data reviewed by the Arizona Republic, among the highest population levels in recent years. However, researchers at Syracuse University's Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse found that when adding the reported average daily population figures from each individual facility, the number only totaled 42,221, as they said in a July 18 online publication. Congress allocated nearly $3.5 billion to fund ICE's capacity to hold immigrants in custody, resulting in 41,500 beds in detention centers. Regardless of which number is correct, the figures show the system is operating over ICE-funded capacity. The passage of the Budget Reconciliation Bill, otherwise known as the One Big Beautiful Bill, in early July, increases spending for immigration detention to $45 billion. That money will be used to increase bed capacity to more than 100,000, according to estimates from groups like the American Immigration Lawyers Association. ICE will now have 13 times its current fiscal budget for detention, which is already operating at a historic high, on top of the funding in ICE's annual budget that Congress sets each year, said Silky Shaw, executive director of Detention Watch Network, a national advocacy coalition pushing to end the use of immigration detention in the United States, in a news statement after the Senate passage of the budget reconciliation bill. As of June 23, Arizona's six immigration detention centers housed an average of 4,089 individuals daily, according to data from the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that collects, researches, and distributes data from federal agencies like ICE. Eloy Detention Center, about 65 miles south of Phoenix, holds roughly one-third of Arizona's detained immigration population, averaging 1,380 people detained at the facility per day. The second highest in the state, behind the La Paz County Adult Detention Facility near the California border. The exact number of people held at Eloy is unclear, as the population fluctuates daily. During an unannounced oversight visit on May 29th, U.S. Representative Yasemin Ansari, Democrat of Arizona, reported that approximately 1,520 of the 1,550 beds at the facility were occupied. Most of the people held at Eloy do not have criminal records, according to ICE's facilities data, as is the case with several of El Delgado's clients. In one case, a couple from Russia was detained at a port of entry in California. Only the husband was paroled. He now resides in Massachusetts, while his wife remains detained. Delgado, a paralegal who manages cases for the Texas-based Eugene Delgado Law Firm, said the Russian woman spent 6 months there before being transferred to the Otay Mesa Detention Center outside of San Diego on July 21st, where she spent 2 months before being transferred to the Eloy Detention Center. She has been detained from the moment that she entered the United States, Delgado said. Several of Delgado's clients have reported an increase in the number of people detained. She said the detention center now deals with overcrowding issues. Maxim Borisov, a gay detainee housed in the male quarters of the Eloy Detention Center since February, told the Republic that some pods began to put three people to a room. Borisov fled Russia in 2023 over fears of violence and retaliation for donating to the Ukrainian war effort, anti-Putin protests, and a LGBTQ lifestyle. He and two family members, also fleeing, sought asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border in 2024 when detained. Our cells are small enough for two people, Borisov, the 22-year-old, said. Everyone is complaining and breaking the beds. When people, including Muslim detainees who said they no longer had space to pray, raised concerns and questioned officers about the decision to place three people in a cell, Borisov said detention staff simply told them they would have to get along with each other. In absolute full and we cannot even turn around, he said. Borisov said the extra beds were removed from the cells and stored for the duration of Ansari's visit. The beds were put back in the cells after her departure, he said. Ansari and Laura St. John, the legal director for the Florence Immigration and Refugee Rights Project, which provides services at the Eloy Detention Center, discussed some of the complaints that they have heard from people inside the facility on a media call. We're hearing from detained folks that there are more people in detention right now than there ever have been, St. John said during the call. Many of the Florence Project's clients have claimed that three people are being put in a room in some pods, she said, describing the move as highly unusual. CoreCivic did not directly address the question of three beds per pod, but said the company takes seriously its obligation to adhere to all applicable federal detention standards in all our ICE-contracted facilities, including Eloy. All of our immigration facilities operate with a significant amount of oversight and accountability, including being monitored by ICE officials on a daily basis, to ensure an appropriate standard of living and care for every detainee, Todd said. The Eloy Detention Center, as with all our immigration facilities, is audited regularly and without notice several times a year, and routinely visited by elected officials, attorneys, families, and volunteers, he said. People detained at the Eloy facility get 3 nutritious meals a day, Todd said, and staff members take great care to offer meals that support specialized diets, including religious diets and more than a dozen therapeutic diets, as well as cultural preferences. Menus are reviewed and approved on a regular basis by a registered dietitian to ensure appropriate nutrition is provided, he said. This menu review includes the common fare diet and religious diets, including food, portions, and nutritional content. Overcrowding is just one of many issues of concern for attorneys and advocates monitoring conditions inside civil immigration detention centers. Inadequate medical care has remained a persistent worry across Arizona's detention system, repeatedly flagged by human rights organizations, elected officials, and legal professionals. In 2024, the Florence Project released 2 reports detailing the formal complaints it filed with federal oversight agencies on behalf of detained clients. Of the 75 complaints filed across 3 Arizona facilities, nearly half originated from the Eloy Detention Center. Medical care was among the top concerns, with complaints ranging from delayed access to medical records to missed doses of prescription medications. Borisov described several instances where he has experienced issues obtaining medications needed for his mental health conditions. Among the most consequential, Borisov said he was not given the prescribed pills he had previously taken for the past 9 years to help with an anxiety disorder. Borisov noted that this greatly affected his ability to explain why he sought refuge in the U.S. during his Convention Against Torture interview, afforded to individuals who express they are at risk of torture by their governments. CAT, C-A-T, for short, is harder to qualify for than the asylum and lacks benefits such as a path to citizenship, but it would allow Borisov to avoid deportation to Russia. Borisov said he had a panic attack during his interview. He was denied protection under CAT. He has since made detention officials aware of his issue receiving his medications, requesting another interview. That request has been denied repeatedly. Such lapses can prove especially dangerous for individuals with serious or life-threatening conditions. Todd emphasized what he called CoreCivic's limited but important role in America's immigration system. It's important to understand that CoreCivic has a long-standing zero-tolerance policy not to advocate for or against any legislation that serves as the basis for or determines the duration of an individual's detention, he said in his written statement. CoreCivic does not enforce immigration laws, arrest anyone who may be in violation of immigration laws, or have any say whatsoever in an individual's deportation or release. CoreCivic also does not know the circumstances of individuals when they are placed in our facilities. Our responsibility is to care for each person respectfully and humanely while they receive the legal due process that they are entitled to. A national report released in June 2024 by a coalition of human rights groups found that most of the 17 detainees with human immunodeficiency virus interviewed at ICE facilities nationwide reported significant problems accessing adequate HIV care, including delays, denials, and inconsistent medication availability. ICE's performance-based national detention standards mandate that individuals diagnosed with HIV receive care in line with national guidelines from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the CDC, and Infectious Diseases Society of America. The standards also state that detainees may request HIV testing at any time and must be clinically evaluated if presenting symptoms suggestive of HIV. Sarawit Gazahegan-Dejain, a 45-year-old asylum seeker from Ethiopia, died in ICE custody in January from complications related to untreated HIV. According to ICE's detainee death report, Dejain's critical health issues went unidentified for months, despite his deteriorating condition and multiple evaluations by medical staff. No mention of HIV appeared in ICE's medical summaries before his emergency hospitalization. Dejain was taken into custody by U.S. Border Patrol near Lukeville on August 19, 2024. And transferred 2 days later to Eloy Detention Center. During his medical intake, a licensed practical nurse documented that Dejain denied any prior health conditions and cleared him for general population housing. But in the weeks that followed, Dejain repeatedly sought medical attention, beginning with back pain. Dejain visited the facility's medical unit 4 times between November 3rd and December 16th. Each time, he was given a single dose of pain medication in line with treatment protocols for musculoskeletal pain. By December 20th, Dejain reported new symptoms and a nurse practitioner referred him to Banner Casa Grande Medical Center, where he was diagnosed with probable lymphoma, a type of cancer that affects the body's ability to fight off infections. Lymphoma is an AIDS-associated cancer, according to the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. People with HIV are up to 50 times more likely to develop the most common type of this cancer, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, according to an explainer posted online by the center. On New Year's Eve, he was airlifted to Banner University Medical Center, Phoenix, and admitted to the ICU. There, doctors quickly identified his immunocompromised status and diagnosed a cascade of conditions, in addition to the earlier findings. His condition continued to deteriorate, and he was placed on a ventilator in early January. On January 29, 2025, after a conference call between ICE's Health Service Corps, Enforcement and Removal Operations, and Dejean's family, life support measures were withdrawn. The Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office determined the cause of death to be complications of multiple infections in the setting of human immunodeficiency virus. His death was ruled natural. The prolonged delay in diagnosis and treatment drew criticism from medical experts and advocates. None of the medical screenings that they did found that he was HIV positive, St. John said during the media call after Ansari's visit. He went for months in custody without being treated for this disease. ICE said in a statement to the Republic in response to questions surrounding Dejean's death that any death in custody is one too many. Burgos Ortiz, the ICE spokesperson, said it prioritizes the health, safety, and well-being of all non-citizens in its care and remains committed to ensuring that all those in its custody reside in safe, secure, and humane environments, and that it was a long-standing practice to provide comprehensive medical care from the moment a non-citizen enters ICE custody. Other federal officials have suggested some deaths are inevitable. People die in ICE custody. People die in jails and state prisons. Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, said in responding to a White House reporter's question about the death of a 75-year-old Cuban man who was detained at a Florida facility. The question should be, how many lives does ICE save? Because when they go into detention, we find many with diseases and stuff we deal with right away to prevent that. Beyond concerns over living conditions and medical care, attorneys say systemic delays and funding cuts are making it increasingly difficult for people in ICE custody to access legal representation. In April, the Trump administration moved to end the Legal Orientation Program, a program described as bare minimum necessary to protect due process rights by the Florence Project's legal director. Without the program, hundreds of thousands of migrants will face the full force of U.S. legal system without any sort of legal education or support, leading to disastrous and potentially deadly outcomes, St. John said in a written statement in April. The Florence Project, along with eight other immigrant rights organizations, filed a renewed temporary restraining order on the sunset of the program. The Trump administration's move has created obstacles for the nonprofit to continue its Know Your Rights presentations, which are held inside Eloy and other detention centers. Organizers of the presentations no longer have the same access to information on who will appear before an immigration judge for the first time. We relied on those lists that were provided by the facility through this federal program to make sure that when we created a list of who we were going to talk to, St. John said. Their clients are telling the Florence Project about an increase in the number of people at Eloy Detention Center, but she said she couldn't confirm that without access to population list. At the same time, she said, the nonprofit is providing legal education to far fewer people. The poor conditions described at Eloy are occurring as the federal government simultaneously expands detention operations and dismantles internal oversight mechanisms designed to monitor abuse. On March 21st, hundreds of employees at the Department of Homeland Security's three key watchdog offices, the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, the Office of the Immigration Detention Ombudsman, and the Citizenship and Immigration Services Ombudsman, were suspended via mass email, effectively shutting down the offices, according to court documents filed in April. A lawsuit brought by advocacy groups including Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights and the Southern Border Communities Coalition argues that the Trump administration's move to eliminate oversight offices mandated by Congress is unlawful. The administration maintains that the offices have not been eliminated. Michelle Brunet, who served as the head of the Office of Immigration Detention Ombudsman from April 2024 until the change in administration in 2025, said the office was created to fill a critical accountability gap inside Department of Homeland Security detention operations, and that the gap now is left gaping open. The problem for decades was that oversight of detention facilities just didn't seem effective, Brunet told the Republic in June about how the watchdog office came to be. The idea came from the concept of saying, maybe if there's somebody working from the inside, trying to resolve problems, that might help get at the matter. Before leading the Detention Oversight Office, Brené worked on former President Joe Biden's Family Reunification Task Force as the executive director. The Office of the Immigration Detention Ombudsman was established by Congress in 2019 with a mandate to promote safe, humane conditions in immigration detention by independently examining ICE and CBP facilities. The Ombudsman's office was tasked with investigating complaints from detained individuals and issuing recommendations to improve agency operations. Brené coordinated a team of more than 100 employees and experts from various fields who conducted site visits to assess conditions across the 200 ICE detention facilities. Much of their work consisted of thousands of little corrections made daily. "That was great, and I didn't want that to stop," Brené said. "But there's a lot more an ombudsman could be doing in terms of fixing some of those systemic issues." The most common complaints Brené's office received were related to medical care, from detainees claiming they received the wrong medication or having trouble getting an appointment, she said. "We were in the process of digging deeper into the medical issues," Brené said. "One big finding we made was that so many of the issues were around staffing." According to CoreCivic's spokesperson, staffing patterns are reviewed and approved by our government partners at ICE. Todd also suggested that both public and private correctional agencies across the country, and indeed many industries more broadly, have faced staffing challenges in recent years. CoreCivic has been laser-focused on addressing staffing in several ways, Todd said, through encouraging public service-oriented individuals to give the challenging but fulfilling field of corrections a try, and also by providing their team members with the support and tools necessary to make work at CoreCivic a career. "We're proud of our dedicated team at EDC, the Eloy Center, who work hard every day to keep those in our care safe while providing for their needs as they progress through the civil immigration process," he said. The most recent compliance inspection by ICE's Office of Professional Responsibility found a similar complaint about medical care, while representatives from its Office of Detention Oversight, an office separate from the Office of the Immigration Detention Ombudsman, interviewed 46 detainees. After the inspection, the Office of Detention Oversight downgraded Eloy Detention Center's previously awarded superior facility rating to acceptable or adequate because of an increase in deficiencies related to the handling of detainees' personal property. With mass layoffs at DHS watchdog offices now in effect, Brené warned that a system already under strain has become far less transparent. Ansari, the Arizona Democrat, expressed concerns in a June 13th letter to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and Acting ICE Director Todd Lyons after her visit at the Eloy Detention Center. Among Ansari's requests, she asked Noem and Lyons to provide detailed data on the complaints filed with the Office of Immigration Detention Ombudsman and the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties over the past year, including the number of complaints that were adequately investigated and the response times of agencies. The death of the 75-year-old Cuban national detained at a Florida facility at the end of June brings the total number of people who have died in ICE custody to 13 so far in fiscal year 2025, surpassing the total number of deaths from the previous year in just half the time. As the number of people in detention continues to climb, Brené fears the rollback of independent oversight will lead to unchecked abuse. For its part, CoreCivic pointed to what it calls its robust grievance process for people in detention. "We have a robust process available to all detainees that provides multiple safe and discrete avenues for concerns to be raised, including toll-free telephone numbers," Todd of CoreCivic said. "All detainees also have access to management staff. Most detainee complaints are processed through ICE's Office of Enforcement and Removal Operations, Detention Removals and Information Line." Alarcon Gomez described what she called unprofessional behavior from staff during the May 5th incident. After making it out of the building, Alarcon Gomez and the rest of the women housed inside several Charlie pods were screamed at and insulted, she said, and instructed to move toward the basketball courts, where they were told to lie on the ground. Feeling overwhelmed by everything that had happened, some of the women began to cry, she said. One woman, Alarcon Gomez had befriended during her time in the detention center, began to lose consciousness. Alarcon Gomez's roommate held on to her as she lost her footing and collapsed. "We all thought she died," Alarcon Gomez said. A guard approached the roommate and instructed her to leave. The woman was left on the ground. Alarcon Gomez said an ambulance took 15 minutes to arrive. The paramedics delivered CPR. They used a bag valve mask on her to try to provide ventilation. When that didn't work, The paramedics attached an automated external defibrillator to her to deliver electric shocks to restore her heartbeat. They were able to finally reanimate her, Alarcon Gomez said. When the Republic asked if a woman was revived during the emergency, ISIS Burgos Ortiz said that a detainee collapsed during evacuation, but emphasized it was unrelated to the incident. The detainee was transported to the Banner Casa Grande Medical Center for further evaluation, Burgos Ortiz said. ISIS timeline of the May 5th incident, including evacuation and time spent outside, indicates that detention officials handled the emergency in 30 minutes. Alarcon Gomez was released from the Eloy Detention Center and deported through a port of entry in Nogales on May 22nd, but still remembers what happened that day vividly. "Of course we were scared," she recalled. "We unfortunately were witnesses to something very lamentable." Like many other Mexican citizens expelled from the country through Arizona, she visited the Kino Border Initiative. There, Tracy Horan, the nonprofit's associate director of education and advocacy, helped Alarcon Gomez fill out a complaint addressed to the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, as well as the Office of the Immigration Detention Ombudsman. In the June 5th complaint, she lists a number of allegations of mistreatment while she was in Customs and Border Protection and ICE's custody, including the May 5th incident. Horan said that, after the submission of the complaint, she has not received any correspondence from the watchdog office. She explained that, typically, she would receive an automatic response confirming the receipt of her complaint. She got one in response to an April complaint that informed her that the Office of the Immigration Detention Ombudsman had been abolished and the inbox would no longer be monitored. Since April, Horan has submitted 3 complaints to the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties and copied the Office of the Immigration Detention Ombudsman and has not heard back from either office. The next article is titled, "So Much Has Been Taken. Apache Women Sue to Halt Land Swap for Oak Flat Copper Mine," by Deborah Utasia Kroll, Arizona Republic. A group of Apache women asked a federal judge in Washington, D.C. to halt a disputed land exchange at the center of a long battle over plans to build a huge copper mine at Oak Flat. It's the 4th lawsuit that seeks to stop the U.S. Forest Service from signing over title to the site, held sacred by Apache peoples and culturally significant by other tribes, to Resolution Copper in exchange for other plots of environmentally sensitive land in Arizona. The 4 women, who all have spiritual and cultural connections to the 2,200-acre campground in Tonto National Forest, about 60 miles east of Phoenix, filed their suit in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia July 24th. Nelson Mullins, a law firm based in Washington, D.C. and South Carolina, outlined the case, which asked Judge Timothy J. Kelly, an appointee of President Donald Trump, to stop the exchange until the plaintiffs can have their day in court. The suit claims the exchange violates the Religious Freedoms Restoration Act, the plaintiffs' First Amendment-guaranteed religious rights protections, and 2 environmental laws. "So much has been taken from our people," Zanetta Lopez, one of the plaintiffs, said in a statement that accompanies the filing. "Being told that they should be content to hold their ceremonies at the San Carlos Apache Reservation instead of their sacred place amounts to a misunderstanding of their practices," she said. "It is the original place and has a special power and connection with the Ga'an, messengers between the Creator and humans, and the white-painted women, or changing women, the first matriarch of our people." She said those connections are unique to Oak Flat. The lawsuit also brought 2 new factors into play, a recent high court decision that affirms parental rights to direct their children's religious education, and references to Justice Neil Gorsuch's blistering dissent to the Supreme Court's refusal to hear Apache Stronghold's case. "The court's decision to shuffle this case off our docket without a full airing is a grievous mistake, one with consequences that threaten to reverberate for generations," Gorsuch wrote in May. Resolution, which asked to become a party in the newest lawsuit, said the litigation was a transparent attempt to litigate issues that have already been decided by the courts that govern the projected site. And the federal government questioned the timing of the litigation and asked why it took so long for the women to come forward with their religious objections. Traditionally, in Indian country, women are given the responsibility to pass cultural teachings to the next generation. The roles that American Indian and Alaska Native women serve, including matriarchs, life bearers, cultural teachers, artists, storytellers, homemakers, healers, writers, and mentors, is profound, said Cheyenne and Arapaho writer Montoya A. Whiteman. "The strength, knowledge, spirit, ingenuity, and beauty of past generations are in each of us." Apache people are no exception. The women asking the court to halt the exchange each issued personal statements about what Oak Flat meant to them, spiritually, how they pass religious and cultural teachings to their own children, and why the site should be preserved. Angela Kinsey said her family regularly traveled to Oak Flat for acorn picking, gathering medical plants, and ceremonies. "To me, Oak Flat is home," she said. "It is our religious home. You can't recreate what is there." Nomi Brown said her grandfather's illness was healed after visiting Oak Flat and receiving blessings and prayers. Brown, 21, held her sunrise dance ceremony at the site in 2020. They said if she ever has children of her own, passing on Apache faith and traditions would require experiencing Oak Flat and its direct connection to the Creator. "If the government's plan to destroy Oak Flat goes through, it would be devastating to my people and to me specifically," Brown said. "It's not only a place where I practice my faith, but a part of me, and of all Apaches would be gone." Lopez said she wanted her 11-year-old daughter to have the same opportunity to practice Apache religion as her older daughter, 21-year-old Goyen Brown, another plaintiff in the suit. Lopez said her younger daughter, who suffered from Graves' disease, also was healed by the waters at Oak Flat. "If Oak Flat is destroyed, I will be unable to pass on my faith on to my daughters or raise them with the ceremonies and spiritual experiences that are central to our Apache religion," Lopez said. For more than two decades, Oak Flat Campground, known to Apaches as Chili Bildagotil, the place where the emery oak grows, has been ground zero in a battle over native religious rights on public lands and to preserve one of Arizona's most scarce commodities, a working wetland. The campground and riparian zone lie over one of the nation's largest remaining bodies of copper. Resolution said the site has the potential to become one of America's biggest copper mines. A spokesperson for the company said the mine would contribute $1 billion annually to the state economy and provide thousands of jobs in the copper triangle. The spokesperson also said that significant consultation and review of the project has led to major changes in the plan to preserve and to reduce potential impacts on tribal, social, environmental, and cultural interests. Tribes, environmentalists, and their allies have been fighting to prevent Oak Flat from being given to Resolution Copper in the exchange. The company had pursued the land with Forest Service for about 10 years before it was attached to a defense bill in December 2014 by a group of lawmakers led by the late Senator John McCain. To obtain the copper ore, Resolution, which is owned by multinational firms Rio Tinto and BHP, will use a method known as block cave mining, in which tunnels are drilled beneath the ore body and then collapsed, leaving the ore to be moved to a crushing facility. Eventually, the ground will subside, leaving behind a crater about 1,000 feet deep and nearly 2 miles across where Oak Flat and its religious and environmental significance now stand. Grassroots group Apache Stronghold filed a lawsuit in January 2021 in federal court to stop the land swap, citing religious rights guarantees under the First Amendment and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, a religious freedom nonprofit law firm, accepted the case and, along with a group of private attorneys and law professors, has represented the Apache Stronghold, which includes Apache and other Native peoples and their allies. The San Carlos Apache Tribe and a consortium of environmentalists and Arizona tribes filed their own suits. Those two lawsuits were placed on hold pending the issuance of the new EIS. The Biden administration rescinded the environmental impact statement in March 2021 for further consultation with tribes. The Forest Service announced a consultation concluded in 2023. Resolution was granted permission to join the lawsuit in 2023. In 2024, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against Apache Stronghold in a 6-5 decision. That fall, the group appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Forest Service's announcement in April that the process would move forward again set off a flurry of court filings to stop or at least put the move on hold, which opened up a 60-day period beginning June 20th, when the new EIS was filed, within which the land exchange could take place. Apache Stronghold won a temporary halt to the proceedings until the High Court either decided not to take the case or issued a decision. The Supreme Court turned Apache Stronghold down in May. Apache Stronghold, in turn, has asked the High Court to reconsider its request to have the case heard. On June 9th, U.S. District Judge Dominic W. Lanza barred the Forest Service from completing the land exchange until August 19, the required 60 days after the new EIS was issued, to give parties from other two lawsuits sufficient time to review the environmental impact statement and revive their litigation. The tribe and environmentalists jointly asked Lanza to halt the exchange until their two lawsuits have run their course. Lanza will hear arguments August 6th. The federal government asked why it took the group so long to file a suit. Plaintiffs waited to file their motion for more than 3 months after federal defendants provided public notice of their intent to publish the final environmental impact statement, FEIS, for the Resolution Copper Mine project, the administration's attorneys argued. They also asked that the case be transferred to the Arizona District Court, where other Oak Flat cases have been adjudicated. Resolution said the federal courts have all sided with the government and the copper mine to allow the project to move forward. It is time that plaintiffs stop attempting to use the courts to delay a project that was mandated by a bipartisan act of Congress more than a decade ago, supported by three presidential administrations, and has been upheld under settled law by courts at every level, the spokesperson said. The women's attorney said the issue needed a fresh review in light of Gorsuch's statement. The federal government's participation in the intentional and needless destruction of an irreplaceable Native American sacred site violates multiple federal laws and the U.S. Constitution, a spokesman for law firm Nelson Mullins told the Arizona Republic. As Justices Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas recently observed, it would be a grievous mistake to allow this to occur without a full airing of the important legal issues at stake. We hope Judge Kelly will agree. Lopez said the threat to Oak Flat is a threat to her ability to practice Apache religion and pass her religion to her daughters. This is one of the few sacred places we have left that is still alive, she said. Discounting the power of that place is like saying to Christians that there isn't anything unique or special about the Church of the Holy Sepulchre or the places Jesus walked. We wouldn't let those places be turned into copper mines. You are listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Neil Kelly, and we'll continue with the news. The next article is titled, Worker Dies After Becoming Trapped at a Goodyear Construction Site. Here's What We Know, by Ray Covarrubias, Jr., Arizona Republic. A worker in Goodyear died after becoming trapped in a trench at a construction site on July 29th, according to the Goodyear Fire Department. The incident happened on the outskirts of northwestern Goodyear, where a man was buried with dirt inside a trench at a construction site in a developing neighborhood, which led to a rescue operation that went on until the man's body was found the next morning. First responders worked a complex and dangerous rescue operation that ultimately ended in authorities locating the man dead, according to Ruben Rial, a spokesperson for the Goodyear Fire Department. The Goodyear Police Department identified the man on July 29th as Ronald Andrew Becerra, Jr., 44, according to spokesperson Sergeant Mayra Reeson. The man's last name was originally misspelled in information provided to the media, Reeson said. Here's what we know about the death of the worker. A regular Monday on a construction site turned into a rescue operation that lasted for over 12 hours, according to the Goodyear Fire Department. It started around 1:10 p.m. July 28th, when a worker became stuck in a trench near 183rd Avenue and Lower Buckeye Road, according to Rial. The fire department responded within 6 minutes of receiving the call, Rial said. The Goodyear Police Department, Phoenix Fire Department's Technical Rescue Team, APS, and Southwest Gas Workers were also on hand to assist with the rescue. Fire crews arrived and found workers actively attempting to rescue their co-worker, who was buried under a large amount of dirt, according to Rial. Crews joined the efforts but were unable to reach the man due to the amount of dirt that created unstable conditions in the trench, according to Rial. Crews said the trench continued to collapse as dirt was removed, which created dangerous conditions for the man and all crews involved, according to Rial. After about 30 minutes, crews switched to a more methodical recovery approach for the safety of the crews involved, according to Rial. Police secured the area while crews worked through the night, according to Reeson. Operations resumed into the evening and working through the night with heavy equipment from utility partners, crews removed from the worker's body from the trench around 2 a.m. July 29th, according to Rial. Rial said the incident remained under investigation alongside partner agencies. The construction site was near single-family homes being built in the area of 183rd Avenue and Lower Buckeye Road, but the type of construction the man was working on at the time of the incident was not known, Rial said. The Goodyear Police Department dispatch system identified the worker as Ronald Andrew Becerra, Jr., 44. The Goodyear Fire Department and Goodyear Police Department would like to extend their deepest condolences to the workers' family, friends, and co-workers during this difficult time, Rial said. Goodyear Police extended the same sentiment. We join the Goodyear Fire Department in extending our sincere condolences to the workers' loved ones during this tragic time, Reason said. Becerra's family declined to speak with the Arizona Republic at the scene. Goodyear Police were on the scene. Additionally, the Compliance Division of the Industrial Commission of Arizona started its investigation July 28th, said Charles Carpenter, a spokesman for the state's Workplace Safety Agency. The results of such an investigation typically take 4 to 5 months, Carpenter said. Recommendations of citations and proposed penalties are presented to the state board for approval. Carpenter said any business can ask the agency for free consulting services. Officers will offer training and will make worksite inspections to discuss safety measures. At least through consultation, you know where your deficiencies are, Carpenter said. The consulting division does not share information with the compliance division, Carpenter said, so businesses should not fear that anything witnessed in the inspection would be used against them in case of an accident. According to a database kept by the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Agency, at least 3 people have died in construction-related trenches since 2019. 2 men died in July 2020 while working in a trench as part of a new home construction, according to the database. 1 man died in Tucson in November 2019 while installing a pipe in a 9-foot trench that collapsed, an incident report said. A Tucson firefighter suffered broken ribs and ankle and knee injuries while attempting to rescue the trapped victim, the database said. We move on to USA Today, and the first article there is titled, Feds Hold Interest Rates Steady. Will September bring a rate cut? Live updates. By Paul Davidson, Bailey Schultz, Andrea Rakir, Joey Garrison, Jim Sargent, Francesca Chambers, and Rachel Barber, USA Today. Washington. The Federal Reserve kept its key interest rate unchanged again and gave no signal it plans to lower rates in September, despite mounting pressure from President Donald Trump and his appointees on the Fed's policymaking committee. The July 30 decision leaves the Fed's benchmark short-term rate at a range of 4.25% to 4.5% for a 5th straight meeting. The Fed remains caught between its 2 mandates, maximum employment and stable prices. A slowing economy and job market in recent weeks has strengthened the case for rate cuts. But Trump's tariffs began pushing inflation higher in June, and forecasters expect larger effects in the months ahead, making officials wary of providing guidance to markets until the impact plays out. Yet 2 Republican Fed governors, Christopher Waller and Michelle Bowman, dissented, saying they preferred to trim rates. It marks the first time 2 governors have dissented from a Fed decision since 1993. Waller has said that while tariffs will likely nudge prices higher, he believes it will be a one-time hit and inflation should return to its prior level next year. Both Waller and Bowman have been mentioned as potential candidates to be elevated by Trump to Fed chair when Powell's term expires in May. In a statement after a 2-day meeting, the Fed said, "Uncertainty about the economic outlook remains elevated," removing its prior assertion that uncertainty had diminished. The more optimistic tone came after Trump had paused many outsized tariffs for 90 days, but a Friday negotiating deadline could reinstate many of the higher levies. The Fed's also said economic activity moderated in the first half of the year, a downgrade from its previous description of growth as solid, that at least could open the door to a September rate cut. In June, Fed officials projected they'll likely approve 2 quarter-point decreases this year, according to their median estimate. Future markets, along with many economists, expect the first in September. Trump has relentlessly tried to bully Fed Chair Jerome Powell into chopping rates dramatically and immediately, calling him a numbskull, a moron, and too late, among other epithets. But during a visit to the Fed last week, he said he doesn't plan to fire him, despite musing previously that he might do so. Fed experts have said a president can only remove a Fed chair for cause, and Trump's repeated attacks threaten the Fed's independence from politics. Powell made clear that the Fed is waiting to see more data before making a call on rate cuts. "We have made no decisions about September. We don't do that in advance," Powell said, adding that the Fed will receive 2 rounds of employment and inflation data to inform its assessment ahead of next meeting. Of the 12 voting members of the FOMC committee, 9 voted in favor of maintaining the target range for the federal funds rate at 4.25% to 4.5%. One was absent for the vote. Michelle W. Bowman and Christopher J. Waller voted against the action, preferring to lower the target range for the federal funds rate by 0.25 percentage point at this meeting. It's the first double dissent by Fed governors in nearly 32 years, according to Bankrate chief financial analyst Greg McBride. This will only add to the scrutiny and second-guessing of anything the Jerome Powell-led Federal Reserve says, does, or doesn't do, McBride said in a comment to USA Today. Our next article is titled, Trump Requested Epstein and Maxwell Grand Jury Records Cover Only Two Witnesses, by Aisha Bagchi, USA Today. The grand jury transcripts President Donald Trump is seeking in New York as he tries to quell his base's outrage over the White House's decision not to release files related to Jeffrey Epstein cover only two witnesses, according to the Justice Department. Those witnesses are an FBI agent and a detective with the New York Police Department, DOJ officials said in a July 29 court filing. Both witnesses testified in the federal grand jury proceedings that led to charges against convicted sex trafficker Ghislaine Maxwell, who is currently serving a 20-year prison sentence. Only the FBI agent testified before the grand jury that charged Epstein with sex trafficking in 2019. The fact that just two people are on the witness list, both members of enforcement, could mean the transcripts might not be revelatory, even if they are released. A Manhattan Federal District Court is currently deciding whether to unseal the records for public viewing. Florida Federal District Court separately ruled July 23rd that Epstein-related records tied to federal grand jury proceedings in that state must remain private. The New York police detective who testified in the Maxwell-related proceedings in Manhattan was serving with the FBI's Child Exploitation and Human Trafficking Task Force at the time, according to the Justice Department. The Justice Department offered a couple of indications in the latest court filing that the transcripts might not reveal much that the public doesn't already know. In addition to just having two witnesses in the transcripts, the court filing suggests that at least a significant portion of what those witnesses said may have been repeated at a trial by victims of Epstein and Maxwell. In other words, it wouldn't be new information to the public. Many of the victims whose accounts relating to Epstein and Maxwell that were the subject of grand jury testimony testified at trial consistent with the accounts described by an FBI agent and the detective, according to the Justice Department's filing. Some of the victims also publicized their accounts in the context of civil lawsuits, the department added. Several witnesses testified in Maxwell's month-long trial in 2021, which ended with her conviction for conspiring to entice and transport minors for illegal sex acts with Epstein and sex trafficking a minor to him. Prosecutors said Maxwell helped Epstein recruit, groom, and abuse minor girls from about 1994 to about 2004, including girls as young as 14. Justice Department officials asked for the transcripts to be released at the request of Trump, who said in a Truth Social post on July 17th that he made the request based on the ridiculous amount of publicity given to Jeffrey Epstein. Department officials have called for redacting personal identifying information if courts approve of making the records public. That caveat could further disappoint members of the public who have clamored for the government to release the names of any potential Epstein clients suspected of participating with the disgraced financier in a sex trafficking ring. Several officials in Trump's administration have fanned the flames of those conspiracies for years, including FBI Director Kash Patel, who told right-wing media figure Glenn Beck in 2023 that the head of President Joe Biden's FBI had direct control of an Epstein black book. However, in a memo released July 7th, the Justice Department and the FBI said a review of the government's records on Epstein failed to turn up a client list and that no further disclosures were warranted. In the wake of that memo, even some congressional Republicans have clamored for the file's release or introduced legislation to try to force the Trump administration's hand. Republican leadership has so far blocked the legislation, and White House officials continue to resist those calls. The next article is titled, Did Jeopardy Champion Lose on Purpose? Scott Riccardi Speaks Out, by Brendan Morrow, USA Today. This Jeopardy champion is speaking out about the shocking end of his 16-game winning streak. Who is Scott Riccardi? On July 25th, the engineer from New Jersey lost on the game show after 16 consecutive wins due to a surprising miss on Final Jeopardy. Riccardi subsequently took to Reddit to explain what happened after some of social media who claimed he lost on purpose. The clue that Riccardi answered wrong was in the category of 20th century names. According to one obituary, in 1935, he owned 13 magazines, 8 radio stations, 2 movie companies, and $56 million in real estate, it read. The correct response was William Randolph Hearst, but Riccardi incorrectly guessed who was Howard Hughes. Riccardi said in the lead going into the final Jeopardy, but his opponents both gave the correct response, including Jonathan Hugenberg Dubler, who came from behind with the win after wagering $9,601. Some Jeopardy fans expressed surprise that Riccardi didn't respond correctly. As is often the case when a winning streak ends, there were even claims that he threw the game because he was tired of being on the show. Does anyone think he lost on purpose because he didn't want to come back next season? One commenter on Instagram read. But on the Jeopardy Reddit, Riccardi chimed in to explain the thought process behind his answer. My mind, unfortunately, went straight to Howard Hughes, most due to overestimating the importance of the movie company's part of the clue. Any previous FJs that had come to mind immediately had worked out, so I trusted my initial response on this, he wrote. Riccardi continued that Hearst wasn't on my mind at all, adding that several information, near misses, and a poor understanding of the timelines in the clue really piled up to prevent me from getting what I now understand to be a very gettable clue. Some defended Riccardi by arguing the clue was worded in a confusing way and could have been read to mean that the obituary was written in 1935, which would rule out Hearst. Hugendubler appeared as surprised as anyone by his win, with host Ken Jennings remarking, "He can't believe it." A visibly stunned Hugendubler immediately walked over and shared a hug with Riccardi, who finished his run on the show with a hefty $455,000 in winnings. Riccardi, who will return in the Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions, now ranks number 8 on the game show's all-time leaderboard in terms of highest winnings in regular season play. With $2,520,700, Jennings, who competed on Jeopardy! In 2004 before becoming the show's host, remains number 1. The next article is titled, South Park Isn't Done Mocking Trump. Trailer for next episode skewers president again. By Brendan Morrow, USA Today. South Park isn't finished with President Donald Trump. The Comedy Central show has dropped a trailer for its next episode, which suggests the series will continue mocking Trump after making waves for going after him in its season 27 premiere. The 22nd trailer includes a shot of Trump attending a dinner, where he is sitting at a table with Satan. As a speaker is heard talking about honoring Trump's courage, the president rubs Satan's leg under the table and Satan tells him to stop. It's unclear whether this scene will appear in the next episode, airing August 6th, or whether it was created solely for the trailer. South Park is notorious for not having episodes finished until soon before they air, and during a Comic-Con panel last week, creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone acknowledged they created scenes just to use in a trailer for season 27. But the trailer at least implies that Trump and his relationship with Satan will be continuing storyline throughout the season, rather than a one-off plot. In its season 27 premiere, which aired on July 23rd, South Park skewered Trump and showed him literally getting into bed with Satan. He was animated using real photos of the president placed on an animated body, a parody almost identical to the way the show's 1999 movie depicted Saddam Hussein. The White House fired back at the episode, with spokesperson Taylor Rogers saying in a statement to USA Today that South Park hasn't been relevant for over 20 years and is hanging on by a thread with uninspired ideas in a desperate attempt for attention. One of the main plot lines in the season premiere, titled Sermon on the Mount, was Trump suing the town of South Park. By the end of the episode, the town agrees to do pro-Trump messaging as part of a settlement. The show then cut to a full public service announcement showing a live auction depiction of Trump taking off his clothes and crawling through a desert. The video was introduced with an on-screen graphic that said, Pro-Trump PSA 01 of 50, suggesting there could be more to come in future episodes. In an appearance at San Diego Comic-Con last week, Parker and Stone sarcastically apologized for the episode. "We're terribly sorry," Parker jokingly said. During their July 24 Comic-Con panel, Parker and Stone also acknowledged that they didn't yet know what would happen in the next South Park episode, given how quickly episodes come together. "I don't know what the episode is next week," Parker said. "It's super stressful." The next article is titled, Willing to be Complicit. Booker Yells at Fellow Dems on Senate Floor, by Sudiksha Kochi, USA Today. Washington. New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker yelled at his colleagues in a rare occurrence on the Senate floor this week, arguing they were complicit with President Donald Trump and that his party needs a wake-up call. The exchange occurred on July 29th as Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, Democrat of Nevada, sought to swiftly move a package of bipartisan bills that would increase resources and funding to police departments and officers. Booker objected to the package and offered an amendment that would require the administration to allocate public safety grants without political bias. That ignited Cortez Masto's ire, who complained that Booker hadn't raised his concerns when the bills passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which he sits on, weeks ago. "This is ridiculous. This is an attempt to kill all of these bills," she said. Booker responded, "This, to me, is the problem with Democrats in America right now, is we're willing to be complicit to Donald Trump to let this pass through when we have all the leverage right now." He also got into a heated back and forth with Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, who told him that he couldn't stop bills that come out of a committee and then allow for other bills that fund other parts of your budget in your state. Booker said it was wrong to imply that the police bills were not vital to his state. "What I am tired of is when the President of the United States of America violates the Constitution, trashes our norms and traditions, and what does the Democratic Party do?" he thundered on the Senate floor. "Comply? Allow him? Beg for scraps?" "The Democratic Party needs a wake-up call," he said. Democrats have been divided about how to organize an effective resistance against Trump and break through the cracks of MAGA populism as the party is still recovering after a bruising 2024 election loss. Booker and other progressive Democrats have been urging their colleagues to be more vocal against the administration. "If we don't stand as Democrats, we deserve to lose. But if we stand united, if we stand strong, if we stand with other people, if we tell with a chorus of conviction that America, what this president is doing is wrong, if we stand up and speak that way, dear God, we will win," Booker said. In April, Booker delivered a marathon 24-hour and 5-minute speech on the Senate floor, railing against the Trump administration's policies and actions. "These are not normal times in America, and they should not be treated as such," Booker said at the time. And that is all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Neil Kelly. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.